package says, one, you can get in, and two, you can remain somewhat stable within an individual carrier and bring some new carriers in, I think there are going to be some administrative savings there that will, in fact, lower the overall cost. That is the only, this is not a placebo in my mind. This is not in any way, shape, or form dealing with the underlying problems in terms that sort of are driving higher costs. It does get to a certain aspect of the high administrative costs that exist in the small group market. That's the only thing I can point to on the cost side. It really is this last piece, not the rate setting piece, this last piece really is an availability issue more than anything else.
You
mean a panacea, not a placebo? Oh, I'm sorry, panacea. Excuse me. I also think that when you speak of the pooling arrangements, I also think that it puts in place a very different environment for a pooling arrangement that essentially would leave a pooling arrangement less likely to end up with all the bad risks, to the degree that if you set up a state-sponsored pool or what have you, in a marketplace where you are in with lots of small carriers who are interested only in sort of cherry picking, you may end up getting the worst risk coming over into the pool. In this type of environment, at least it makes it a little bit more competitive.
Of course, we're going to talk more about that later. I think it depends on how you structure the pool as to whether you end up getting high risk folks or not. I mean, you may pool high risk with high risk. We're going to talk about that more. I just like Chris's reaction in more detail to this approach on Senator Collins' bill. But I think it is worth discussing and exploring. Last year, as I recall, in the legislative session, the Division of Insurance gave a very broad statement of support, saying they really didn't know what it did, but they gave enough rope to the insurance industry they might hang themselves, basically. And as I recall, the testimony before the committee. Just wondering if you perhaps specifically indicate to me why now the Division of Insurance is enthusiastically behind it. What do you really see as a benefit, specifically the benefit towards resolving the problems that we're here to resolve, that of overall reducing cost overall? I think it's going to increase. I mean, people may be able to get some insurance, but they're going to pay a whole lot more for that access than they need to. And I'm not sure it will solve the problem.
Thank you, Senator Duncan. This is Chris Almond, the Division of Insurance, once more. The Health Insurance Association of America, to my understanding, created that bill with focus on availability of insurance. And as far as that goal is concerned, I think they met that 100%. They have cut out the pre-existing conditions. They have allowed the moving of individual employees into other arrangements or other insurers that are within that arrangement. What, however, I think has not been ultimately addressed and needs to be further studied, and also from our part needs to be further studied from a regulatory standpoint, is the problem of the affordability as addressed before. Larry made a good point. Indeed, the underwriting cost would decrease because there would be only an element of assessment connected with an actuarial observation if the rates fit. But knowing how insurance companies operate, they will simply load their premium with reserves and reserves and reserves, expecting that if the ratios are worse than anticipated, that they're covered. They won't give away the farm. And so we are in support of the bill and have supported this because we see the availability issue is comfortably addressed. What we internally are studying is how it could be modified that the affordability issue is addressed. At this time, affordability hasn't even been discussed. And that's something that we are intending before the legislative session to come up with observations and studies to that effect. Thank you.
Karen?
I'm not sure where we are on the agenda. Red bar winter matters. I don't understand this bill. I mean, I don't understand what the word insurance is. I see this $5,000. I don't get it. So whatever time it's right to do that. I read it and I can't hear it.
Okay, I guess I need a sense from the task force if we'd like to go into this further at this point, or if we'd like to continue on with the agenda here and Senator Collins may join us later in the day. I don't know if that's what our plans are, but what's the will of the Representative Boyer? You started this down this road. What would you like to do?
I wasn't aware, Mr. Chairman, Mark Boyer, that we were going to wrap up something here, so I didn't want to move into pooling until we touched on this. We've obviously touched on it a bit now. I kind of think we got to push down the road a little bit and then come back to this. I'm only interested because now that we're getting closer to the session, I have a lot of small independent provider, insurance provider types who are saying to me, we need this, we need something like this, and I want to understand it and appreciate it in all of its splendor if it is there before I get behind it, because I think that there probably is this a need for a much more comprehensive approach, and we hear that obviously today, so I think if we move on, maybe we'll have a better picture of the whole.
Okay, and there will be an opportunity to get more in depth on that legislation. Chris, quick comment before we move on.
Yes, Mr. Prisoma, I want to go to the last comment on the subject. I think we meet there at a crossroad, and the crossroad is, if we talk about pooling, leaving bad risks in the combined risk of good risks, it will automatically raise the cost whatsoever. It's unpreventable. Also, I have to mention that the indications of this time of the market are that the risks are getting worse, the experience is getting worse, rates are in an increasing tendency. The cost is automatically raising, independent of anything like that, due to the cost explosion and the drugs, and also the provider's cost has just drastically increased. Trends have gotten up, so increases are there. If we talk about taking those bad risks out of the good risks and try to separate them, is that by forming a high-risk pool, that will make an impact, will have an impact on the affordability. And I think that's something we need to keep in mind. Thank you.
Rod? Just a quick comment. This is Rod Wilson. I think we're at an even larger, wider crossroads, and that is whether the workplace is the appropriate place to base health care insurance at all. It's not working very well for big employers. It's certainly not working for small employers. It seems to be the traditional way to do things in the United States, and most of the national bills and so forth seem still want to link it to burden to the workplace, but it simply is not working, and I wonder if the future is brighter and dimmer than it is now.
Mary, did you have a comment on that?
A broad one. I guess that in terms of looking at that issue, I think one of the things that, to be quite frank, you may have to look at is what is the larger picture at the national level. And to be quite honest with you, and I know all of you have been talking about the Pennsylvania race and the higher focus that healthcare coverage has gotten. The fact of the matter, Dr. Wilson, is that the champions of doing a more public program that is not employment-based, Ted Kennedy's and others of the world, have, for whatever political reasons, not necessarily for efficiency or philosophical reasons, have moved off that. And most of the discussion, with the exception of one piece of Marty Russo's legislation, most of the leadership approaches, certainly on the Democratic side, which is what's pushing it, still keep that link to the workplace. And they look at pay-or-play type approaches that use the place of employment as the mechanism for providing the coverage or what have you. So I think that's the only thing I can add to that discussion, is just sort of looking at sort of what the lay of the land is at the national level.
If I may respond to that, that's Rob Wilson. There was one other suggestion by Harvard professor, school business, Regina Hertzlinger, that really individuals could do this better. It ties in what Chris was saying about individual policies and small places employers often are cheaper than the groups. And she suggested the employer simply should give the money to each employee in wages and let the person go out and shop. So it wouldn't necessarily be a broad social program.
Okay, let's move along then on the agenda to an overview of the concept of pooling.
Well, I'll try to give a little background on it. I'm not necessarily the expert on this area. I'm sure there are others who want to join in. In fact, on the last task force that they really reviewed this, I think Representative Boyer, Representative Navarre, and Karen Perdue, all three served on that task force. so they may be wanting to chime in and pass some information. Nancy put together, I think, a pretty good package on the pooling concept with some information in it, if you've had a chance to read it. So I think it's beneficial. If you haven't, you should take a look at it. The task force, the Health Care Cost Containment Task Force, was in existence in 1989, 1990, looked at the pooling concept pretty extensively. We also continued that look with the second task force. There is some background information in the packet concerning Utah and Hawaii. There are two states that we looked at primarily as far as pooling goes. They both had somewhat of a different approach, but I think the information indicates that the pooling did work in those areas. Utah, for example, pulled together all public employees who participated in the plan that they put together. They went so far as to negotiate the provider payments and utilization standards, kind of a preferred provider arrangement for participants in that pooling arrangement. According to the information in the packet, they were able to hold the premiums for individuals in that pool to an increase of 6.6% a year. This is information provided in 1990, so it'll be a change since then. But from 6.6% a year to compared to 12.2% a year for plans that were outside the pool. So it appears that the pooling concept did work. Hawaii also pooled together public employees, a large group of public employees, 110,000 and their dependents. They did not enact, at least the information that we had at that point, and I haven't followed up on, they did not have in their plan any cost containment provisions. Therefore, they may not have controlled the rise as much as they did in Utah. But it also appears to have been working in Hawaii. There's also, I think, some information in the packet that kind of speaks to the problem that we've discussed about pooling high risk with low risk. And I think in any pooling concept, there's a need for a number of subgroups that you don't want to pool together high risk individuals with low risk individuals, but you want to break those out into separate groups. Otherwise, the impact of that, of course, is to increase the premiums for those individuals who are presently probably insured or considered low risk. So any type of pooling arrangement would have to be broken out into subgroups. There's also some precedent for pooling in other areas. For example, in Alaska, pooling has worked for the Alaska Municipal League, not in the area of health insurance, but the Alaska Municipal League has pooled together municipalities for workers' comp, property, and casualty. Liability coverage, and that has been successful in the state of Alaska. So pooling concept can work. I think it's shown that it has worked in other states, and the examples in the packet make that very clear. I think it can work in the state of Alaska as far as health insurance goes. There are several proposals before the legislature right now that deals with pooling. One of those is a bill that's introduced by Senator Kutula, and I'm not going to try to get into it and explain it. Senator Kutula is a member of the committee, but he hasn't been present yet. He can explain that piece of legislation when he does come around. I haven't had a chance to look at it in great detail. And then there's another piece of legislation which I introduced in the Senate, Representative Boyer introduced in the House, that deals with pooling. It's much more comprehensive probably than Senator Kutula's bill is, but it has as an integral part of it the pooling mechanism. I might also add one other area that if you're looking through your packet, these pages aren't numbered very well, so you may not be able to find it, but it's Section C, Review of Pooling Part 3, is somewhere 8 or 10 pages into your packet. There's a two-page analysis of the feasibility of pooling health care in Alaska, and this was done by the former task force and by the consultant we had for the task force to indicate what might be some of the savings, and this again was a projection on consultants part, the savings as a result of pooling, what steps needed to be taken, of course, and then what might be the savings. And he's broken it down for simplification of administration, 1 to 3%, and we have been talking about in the legislation, both Representative Boyer and I introduced provider payment schedules and agreements, which is a very non-controversial area of the legislation, which would have, could generate some savings. The bottom line was that the consultant was projecting somewhere in the neighborhood of 20, at a minimum 20% cost savings. So, again, those projections, but based on what's happened in Utah, for example, I think that's very feasible. What I would do, and then I'd ask either Representative Boyer, Representative Barr, or Karen to add to this, if they would like, is just very briefly explain how I think the last task force viewed the pooling arrangement working in the state of Alaska to avoid some of the problems that might be there if you pool together high risk with low risk individuals.
And it's, as I said, a pretty comprehensive approach and somewhat controversial. I'm sure the individuals on this committee would not agree with it. First of all, of course, you need to create some type of entity to bring this all together. And the proposal in Senate Bill 83, and I can't recall the cost of the number, 73 or 70-something, was to create a state entity, a health resources entity, I forget what the exact name of it was, to put together the mechanisms in order to facilitate cooling for individuals who presently have coverage and for those who don't have coverage. And we broke that into two phases. The first phase, because I'm still convinced, and nothing that I've read lately has changed my mind, that you really don't provide access until you get control on cost. If you do access first and then try to control cost, you continue to further the problem, that you've got to get some control on cost first, the cost of even in place. The first phase of that authority is do this work to bring cost containment into place, and that's the part that Dr. Wilson likes real well. I'm just assuming he does. That's the
actually, I'm on the fence about it.
Oh, you're on board. Good. It's the area which we've had a lot of debate and discussion on, and it's the area where that you would negotiate with providers and all providers, doctors, hospitals, chiropractors, all providers, to provide reimbursement schedules and utilization standards. That was done in the Utah plan, and it showed that it had some savings. The problem I saw with the Utah plan was it was done with only a select group of people. It was done only with public employees. And if you negotiate only one select group of people with public employees, the danger is that the cost shift to the private sector, or the cost shift to people who aren't in the pool. So the proposal under the legislation we were putting forward was to use public employees in Alaska, the 100 and however many thousand of them there are, and their dependents, use those as the leverage to negotiate reimbursement schedules and utilization standards with the providers, and then make those same schedules available to the private sector, so that it would not impact plan design, would not change carriers, would have nothing to do with what type of co-payment or deductible or what type of coverage was given to any individual. It was only the reimbursement schedules and utilization standards that everyone would be using, trying to put together what we would hope would end up being an all-payer system in the state. The pooling came in then in the second phase after that was done, after cost containment was in place. The idea then was to pool together individuals or groups of people so that better access could be provided. For example, it may be that all public employees would decide to go into one large pool for the purpose of purchasing insurance. That would be left up to the unions or to the employer to decide whether or not they should pool together. All school districts might want to pool together, and all public employees might want to pool together, whatever, in order to have one large purchasing group. But we made it very clear, as it did in Utah, by the way, I think we should talk, one of the states, that the unions, of course, have to be involved in this proposal, otherwise it won't work. Secondly, then, how does that increase access for people outside of the public employee? How do you do that without pulling together risk, high-risk and low-risk individuals? The authority that we created would then identify the groups of people who aren't presently covered or who have who need improved access. Example might be that all retail store clerks who have a difficult time in obtaining insurance in the state because they, a number of reasons, one because they're probably low paid, second because there's high turnover in the industry and it's a very high administrative cost for the insurance industry. But those individuals have a difficult time obtaining insurance. Maybe the fishermen, because of the high risk occupation, have a difficult time, the loggers do, or whatever it might be. This authority would identify those groups of people and pull them together, not mix them, but pull them together, take the high risk people, the loggers, put them into one pool. Fishermen into another pool, the retail clerks into a third pool, create a number of subpools, and put together a basic health insurance plan for those groups. Once that health insurance plan is put together, they would then go to the private sector, to the insurance industry, and with a request for proposal to cover those groups of individuals. And instead of the insurance industry then having to cover small groups, a small retail store is a small group, they could cover 8 to 10,000 retail employees in one plan. Would be put together by the authority, or they could cover the insurance or the loggers or the fishermen, because those individuals would be pulled together by the state authority, and the private sector, the insurance industry, would still be involved because they would then be offering the plan to cover those individuals based upon the criteria put forward by the authority. The insurance industry is a little bit concerned about that. And I think, by the way, that's the way you avoid mixing high-risk with low-risk individuals. You identify the high-risk folks and break them out into separate subgroups and identify you said a number of several. Insurance industry was concerned about that because they believed, or they feared, that the state would become a self-insurer and cover those individuals themselves. And that's possible. But that's why the proposal, I think, has to make it very clear that the first thing you do is you go to the private sector, you go to the present insurance companies in the industry and say, we pool together X number of individuals. We would like a basic preventive health care plan for these individuals. Would you offer one? What is your premium? Here's the basic guidelines. I think the insurance industry would respond to that. Would reduce their administrative costs. Would make it easier for the insurance industry to respond and cover those individuals as a group. If they didn't, if they said we're not interested, then the state, with the approval of the legislature, could become a self-insurer and offer a basic plan themselves, collect the premiums, and cover those individuals. So the pooling, I think, we've kind of expanded upon it, or the proposal was to expand upon it, but I think pooling can work. It's proved to be successful in other states, and of course, could be successful in state last. Bottom line, of course, comes down to what do you do with people who are medically indigent, who can never afford coverage, and finally just pay for those. We put money in the state budget, we pay for those individuals, for people who just don't have any income, who can't afford insurance at any level. But you do that after control costs and after reduce the number of uninsured people in the state of Alaska. So there's a number of subgroups I think we put together into a pooling arrangement, and I think it could be successful. I don't know if Mark or Mike or Karen have anything to add on that information.
Well, as usual, after I hear you speak on the issue, I'm convinced it's the right way to go. But I am kind of curious, though, with Aetna and the Blues roughly controlling 70% of the insurance market for health, and the need apparently to restructure the whole regulatory framework and the whole pooling aspect. It seems to me that you got to be able to, leverage the providers, and we were real close, as Larry said, to a single payer system, just given the market dynamics of the 70% control of the marketplace by Aetna and the Blues. It seems that it would be an easy thing for us to restructure the regulatory, make the regulatory changes that we need, and encourage the two majors to come into this market for small employers in any event, and then work through a pooling arrangement if we set that mechanism in place to provide broader access and not allow for the increases in costs that would occur if you didn't do something to get something simultaneously. And I hate to keep putting things back on Steve or anybody else, but it seems like we've got an opportunity that, and while there will probably continue to be some kind of opposition within the ranks of those very small companies that are currently in the small provider or small employer marketplace, that we've got a unique opportunity that doesn't exist probably in many other states to pull something together.
If I might just respond, I guess, maybe that does work. The proposal I described, I'm not saying that's the only way to go or the absolutely 100% perfect way to go. I guess my concern is they may do that. We may be able to leverage them to do that, but then we end up cautioning. I mean, right now they're not in that market because it's costing them more money. I mean, it's an administrative nightmare, apparently, from what I've read. What I know. I know that insurance industries have no quote list and restricted quote list in this state. They have them in every state. And I got a copy of those. You go down that list, you see retail stores, grocery stores, print shops. I mean, these are not high-risk occupations for the most part. Grocery store, you trip overhead a cabbage or something, but it's not a high-risk occupation, but they don't quote those people. Why don't they quote them? Because they're low-income people, low-paid, high turnover, administrative costs are very high for the insurance industry. So I guess maybe we could do that, leverage them into that. But my concern would be, okay, they'll say, we'll cover that. But at the same time, then, that shift is going to be to the public employees or to the large private groups who are presently covered. They're going to see an increase in their premiums. Because administrative costs are going to be the same. If you don't pool those individuals together, I think they're going to have the same administrative costs. We leverage them in, but they're going to say the costs are still there. I think you got to eliminate the cost to a great extent, or reduce the cost. And how do you reduce the administrative cost of the insurance industry? I think you put the groups together. We set up some authority, some entity to do the work for them, to go out and find those 10,000 retail store people, right? And bring them together into a pool and design a plan. And the authority then offers to an RFP says, look, to the insurance industry, we've got 10,000 individuals that need to be covered, and we want preventative care for these people. Here's what it is, right? We brought them together into a group. And I think it may eliminate or reduce to a great extent the administrative cost of the insurance industry and allow them to provide that coverage at a lower rate than if we just leverage them in and they go out and deal with every one of those groups individually. And I think the information that's here on the Utah plan, for example, and others have indicated administrative costs do reduce if you have larger groups to deal with and if you're dealing with small individual employers.
Well, Larry, perhaps you have some general comments on pooling. I agree, obviously, because I've introduced a piece of legislation in a lot of this, but I'm no expert. And again, it just seems that that there is an opportunity if you can make the process so that Aetna and the Blues perhaps don't lose money, so you restructure things so that they can enter this market. They're the heavy hitters, and they ought to be able to provide the kind of coverage then for the groups that Senator Duncan has just suggested aren't covered now. I mean, how does it work? I mean, how you give us a perspective of how things come together in other states, and then given our uniqueness, perhaps how things might come together here.
I think the bit of the difficulty that I guess I'm having is the assumption that we set these things up as mutually exclusive, that you do pooling but you don't do something else, or you do this regulatory approach and you don't do the pooling. I happen to think that the description of the potential benefits from pooling that Senator Duncan discussed to one level or another are real, and I think that there is some real strong basis for looking at pooling approaches. In terms of looking at the regulatory side, I guess in part my view of this whole thing is that they're not mutually exclusive and that they can sort of come together to help one another and split those two regulatory approaches out, one in terms of the small group rate reform and the other one in terms of somehow spreading the risk through the reinsurance or allocation. When I look at pooling, and let's take that as the focus, what the way that I view the regulatory side is to not have, not necessarily the Aetnas, whether or not they come into that market, but some of the other insurers essentially cherry picking, again, sort of saying, we like you guys, we don't like you folks. We think we can make money off you all in terms of the rate we charge. You guys we wouldn't touch, but go down the street and apply to the state pool. And I think to the degree that you just organize that marketplace a little bit so that you compete on all the things that are the good parts of your pool in terms of your ability to get a lower reimbursement rate, your ability to reduce those administrative costs, all those things that are really the positive side, and not necessarily have to compete with these folks that are just trying to skim off the best of the loggers, the best of the retail workers, the best of the thus and such and so, and just say, you know, come with us, you know, here are some problems that exist over in that state pool. We'll take care of you here, and we'll send the others down to the pool. I think that the two pieces sort of cleaning up to one degree or another that small group market, putting in place a pooling mechanism, I think actually fit hand in glove with one another. And I guess I don't necessarily see them as necessarily mutually exclusive. I guess that's how I see the two pieces fitting together. I think there are some real benefits to pooling that may well spill over from public employees down to some of these other pools, but I think you still have a situation where on an individual, particularly in the small group market, you have a tough time talking about all loggers or all thus and such and so and so. I mean, there are lots of these types of pools in other states through the chamber or what have you. And you still have an individual employer decision of whether to purchase or whether not to purchase and where to purchase. And to the degree that they're getting caught by insurers in the small group market that are just saying, you know, you're the one that we want, you know, come on over here and we'll give you this special deal with, you know, this treatment of pre-existing conditions and so on and so forth, this special deal that is nothing more than just sort of skimming off those top risks. I think to the degree that you deal with that, your state-sponsored pool is that much healthier and that much more representative of the full mix that's out there. So I don't see these things as mutually exclusive. In some ways, I think that gets my mind working to say, now how can we really sort of structure this thing so you get all the benefits and you get the pool working in a market that competes not on sort of risk selection or risk avoidance, but on all these other things in terms of the prices, in terms of the administrative overhead, and all the good stuff that you really want to promote in the pool. And that's sort of where my mind goes in terms of sort of fitting these two pieces together.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to make several comments on a couple of different pools that I'm very familiar with. Before I do that, though, I do have to comment on Dr. Wilson's citation of Professor Farquhar, or whoever she was, from Harvard. It's very obvious that whoever that person is has absolutely no concept of the real world. Of if she thinks that it's better to pay the individual employees a certain amount of money and let them go out and work a deal with the insurance industry, she doesn't have a clue as to how the real world works. And I guess by way of analogy, the easiest one to point to of having thousands of people in Alaska going out and trying to negotiate with the insurance industry the best deal for health care, I would liken it to someone going out individually and buying a family car versus Hertz or Avis going out and buying 10,000 and tell me who's going to get the best price break for the cars. And it's certainly not the individual going down to one of the dealers and trying to negotiate on their own. So, I mean, I just have to say, without even knowing any more about it, that just patently ridiculous idea.
I'll send you the article.
I appreciate that. I love to read. I'm very familiar with two pooling concepts that I work with on a daily basis. And one has to do with the insurance and in our business of trying to provide health care for the members. But the other, certainly more important, is I represent the unions. And if there's a concept of pooling and just how it works, and it relates again back to individual versus collectivism in certain areas, and I would just have to say that as a concept, pooling works. Because unions obviously are very healthy in this state, and the concept of pooling is a union concept. I think that probably not just health insurance, but pension plans and others came from the original pooling movement of the unions. People banding together to try to improve whatever it is, whether it's wages or health and welfare or pensions. And enough of that soapbox. I'll just say that as a general concept, I firmly believe that pooling does work. Specifically with regard to health care, I'm the trustee for the Laborers Health and Security Fund, one of eight trustees. There are four from the management side, four employers, and four from the union side. And we direct a pooled fund. You unfortunately have to bear with me because I just got back from a week-long conference on health and welfare benefits and how to better improve our benefits, not just health and welfare, but also pension. So right now I know everything. I'll lose track of it here in the next few days, but it's real fresh. I'll just give you a little history of our insurance health and welfare plan that we have with the laborers. And the numbers have fluctuated some during the pipeline. There were certainly more. During the oil spill a couple of years ago, there was quite a spike. But with those exceptions, our fund has been in existence for almost 30 years in this state. And it's made up by the active members, the working participants from the two construction laborers unions, one in Fairbanks and one here in Anchorage. It also includes our retirees. There are no exclusions. The insurance carrier, whoever it might be, has to take any of the participants, active or retired, warts and all. There's no, if someone becomes eligible on December 1st and they have active cancer or some other expensive medical problem, they're covered. There are no exclusions. Until 1987, we were fortunate enough to live off of the reserves that were built up during the pipeline years for a 10-year period. After the pipeline, we were able to continue in a utopia, certainly not a realistic world. But until 1987, our plan was the Cadillac of health care plans in Alaska. There was a $50 annual deductible, and after that, everything was virtually 100% with no cap. And in 87, we realized that the work certainly wasn't out there anymore as it had been, and there were more retirees, fewer actives. The retirees at that time paid nothing. The actives paid for all of the medical premiums. And we started to make some changes, and in fact, by 1988, the changes were pretty complete, where we now have, instead of the Cadillac, it's just a Buick. It's basic 80-20, $150 deductible, $450 for the family, and in general, probably a normal, quote-unquote, plan that's available out there. We also, at that in 88, required the retirees to start contributing some, and they still don't pay full premium costs, but they do contribute some toward the costs. And 88, 89, 90, we also, in 88, started requiring some mandatory second opinions, and we implemented some cost containment measures that required the members to work a little more to become active in the plan, where before they never had to. All they had to do was submit the bill or have the doctor submit the bill and it was paid. And so we did require some things that, some pre-authorizations for hospital stays and other cost containment measures. And as a consequence of all these things put together, we had no rate increases for 88, 89, or 90. Now in 91, the insurance carrier is coming back with there's going to be an increase, but it's not very substantial. And we're hoping that we're going to be able to convince the contractors that we negotiate with that we'll be able to get an additional rate from the members as far as paying that increase. I just want to end by saying that there are only about 2,000 participants in our plan, so it's not a very big plan. But it is, if you want to look at a pool and whether it works or not, I will absolutely say, yes, it works. We have had many serious medical problems because we also cover all the retirees. And as a consequence, whether it's the cancers or the heart problems, the bypass and all those expensive medical procedures, we have seen the whole gamut. What we are now attempting to do to further make sure that our costs are not increased, we are actively working with several of the other trust funds. Each of the major unions in this state has a plan very similar to ours. There are some nuances, but basically they're all the same vein. We are working with a coalition right now to see if we can't enlarge our pool. We're just the labor's union. The carpenters also have a plan, the Teamsters, the operating engineers, all the major IBEW, all the major local unions in this state have their own separate health and welfare plan. It makes sense to those of us in leadership positions that if we could somehow increase the pool at a very minimum, we would be able to get rid of, each fund has an attorney, each fund has administrative costs, each fund has an actuary and an advisor, and we would at least, even if the insurance rates didn't decrease, and they may not, we'd at least be able to save a considerable amount of money by getting rid of all of those duplications that we now have from all trust funds. So we are working in that direction. The real problem, though, and came home at this conference that I just got back, just returned from, really came home when we talked to those people that have been involved in mergers. The biggest single block of any kind of merger are the egos of the people involved. Certainly there's a survival factor for the attorneys and all that may lose their job, and all the advisors and the administrators that may lose the work that they currently enjoy. So there's a survival factor that is involved with these people wanting to make sure that they stay in business, so they're going to actively work against any kind of merger. That's human nature. But the other thing involved is that with our trust fund, there are 8 trustees, 4 management, 4 labor. Every other trust fund, except for the numbers, it's exactly the same kind of setup. There are individual trustees. None of those people want to give up their positions either. And so the biggest hurdle we have, and certainly the way that I see the greatest benefit of legislation and having kind of a master pool, is it would allow greater access. It also may encourage, as Larry had mentioned earlier, it may encourage those of us that already have a pool to take the next steps that are necessary and try to do what we have to do, and possibly end up with several different, they may not be exactly the same, but several different larger pools. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Madam. Senator Duncan, and then Mark Sanders.
I just wanted to, maybe Larry will want to respond. To respond to a couple of the points that Larry made, follow up after Representative Boyer's question. Well, I would agree with Larry. I don't think any of this stuff is mutually exclusive. I'm not saying that regulatory reform should not be done, cooling should be done, or rebirth schedule, et cetera. I don't think any of this is mutually exclusive. I think we need to do whatever we do needs to be done comprehensively, and that we need to address the problem comprehensively, or we want to solve the problem. Second, on the point of cherry picking, if you go into pooling, if you said that the insurance industry may do, which I guess you mean they take the good ones, right, and the bad ones they leave for the state pools that are set up. I think that's what they're already doing. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that's what's already happening. That's why we have all these retail clerks and other people out there who can't get insurance. I mean, there are certain ones who can. There are certain industries and businesses, depending on their size, and et cetera, that are covered because they're the attractive ones. The administrative costs aren't necessarily that high, so the insurance industry is already cherry picking. And I guess what I'm saying is we need to set up pools to pick up those cherries that fall on the ground. And what you do, what I believe you can do through this authority, is set up those pools, identify those retail clerks who haven't been picked off by the insurance industry, and bring them together into a pool and put together a basic plan for them. But you don't close the pool out at that point. You bring the pool together with those 10,000 clerks, you put together a basic plan, you get a quote from the insurance industry, and you leave it open. And if somebody who already has been picked off by the insurance industry thinks there's a better plan and there's a better premium for them, and in other states. And we need to identify those groups, those individuals who aren't covered, provide that access. That's the only way I think they're going to get access, to bring them together to the pool and ask insurance industry to cover them as a large group instead of small groups. If the industry can't do it, then you go to the self-insurance by the authority and cover them themselves. And I think that's how the private sector finally get coverage for the private sector. We don't have to worry about the access to the public sector, quite honestly. They got the access, we don't worry about the cost. And so there isn't cost shifting from the public sector, and so there isn't cost shifting from the public sector to the private sector. That's why you do the cost containment that you provide the pooling. So that's not as simple as I'm explaining, and nothing is easy in this world, of course. But I think it can work if we recognize the fact that those who are the plumbers, those who are the easy ones to serve, have already been picked up.
Okay, it's Roxanna, then Jerry, and Mike. Oh, Larry, did you want to comment on that?
If I may, I'll try to be brief. I don't think there's much disagreement from the comments that I've heard on the pluses of pooling. And I think we're in agreement on that too, Senator Duncan. I guess just to cherry picking exists in a very blatant way in most small group markets, and I think that the notion that's espoused in terms of trying to set up this pool is to step into that market and say, let's compete. We think we've got some real pluses through this bringing together of numbers of folks, and we're willing to compete on a price basis because we think on these areas. We think our administrative costs can be lower. We think through the implementation of some type of tighter reimbursement rates, we can reduce costs. We can reduce costs in a number of different ways. Put aside for a second, just hold constant for a second, the benefits package. And I guess the way that and I think it's appropriate, the way it was set up in the agenda, to talk about pooling and then talk about the regulatory approach, just to sort of highlight that intersection, I think what we're, and Mano had said it, you use the term healthy pools. And these pools are like animals. They are like a living organism in that they ebb and they flow and they change over time. And a healthy pool has a mix of good risks and poor risks that sort of balance one another out. And I think what, to the extent that cherry picking already goes on, picking up the cherries that sort of were tossed off to the side, gives you sort of that lower end of the higher risk group, if you will. I think to the degree of looking at pooling as your lead approach, and then asking the question, now in terms of getting in and competing in that market and getting that healthy pool, bringing it up to a healthy pool that assumes the risk, what are you going to allow? How are you going to compete? And if you compete on administrative efficiency, if you say, yes, we'll compete on that, we'll compete on prices, we'll compete on utilization review activities, all these things, the regulatory backdrop to some degree says, but what we won't necessarily compete on, or what we don't think are appropriate standards, is risk selection in terms of, you know, just sort of picking people off or just sort of, you know, just saying we're just going to take the good ones, we're opening this up to everyone. And we're not going to necessarily compete on what, and I'll use the term perhaps somewhat inappropriately, deceptive advertising practices, where you go in and say, hey, great introductory rate, folks, come on down here, we can beat the pool, come on in. And by the way, the small print says that we don't cover any pre-existing conditions for, you know, X number of years or what have you. So I think I think the proper context for these regulatory approaches is to say, and what does it do for the environment in which this type of approach that tries to achieve efficiency and administrative structure, tries to get the prices down through market clout or market share, all the things that I think make pools positive. I think that's the proper approach to look and say, does it help or does it hinder the development of these healthy pools? And I think that's exactly the right adjective to use when you're talking about pools.
Thank you. Roxanna Herschel. I wanted to relate something. I think I mentioned it a couple of months ago in one of the meetings, in a personal experience, and something that might be considered when we start talking about pooling. For myself, I have a company that's union and another section that is non-union, 5 employees. The cost of in health insurance went up so much for these 5 employees, I did get individual insurance for each one. I gave them the money and they went out and bought it. The savings, 100%. That's how much difference it was. It was 100% on each one of those policies. So I am very concerned of what's going to happen here when we get into pools. Now we have a very large pool, the laborers pool. You can negotiate with the laborers because you have so many numbers. But what does happen with the small pools, the ones that they don't want? What are the problems we have? What is the minimum wage in Alaska right now? What is, I forget, what is it? $5.50? In some of the unions, that's almost as much as you pay for health insurance per hour, per man hour. What are we doing here? We're saying it's okay to pay somebody to eat and pay rent and buy a car and pay their gas at $5.50 an hour, and it's also okay to go out and pay $5 an hour for health insurance, you know, something. not weighing right here. So what I guess what I'm saying is it's a much bigger problem, and we have to really think about what we're going to do if we get into the pooling and how it's going to be. I disagree that it has to be separated. I feel that that's unfair. I feel that I personally have to do some suffering if we're going to revamp this whole system. I think that personally I need to pay more money. I think me as a business needs to pay more money. I think insurance industry needs to have some suffering. I think the hospitals need to. I think the doctors need to. I think all of us need to really do some soul searching and cut in all areas and to separate these markets and say the fishermen have to pay more than the state office clerks and, you know, all through the industry here. I think that it should be more where we can bring them all in together and have some suffering. There's many areas where the large pooling are receiving insurance from the insurance industry that are going and negotiating certain prices. I think that's awful. Why should anyone be charged less than another person for the same type of procedure? I think that that's one area that we should look out right away. And by putting in poolings, what's going to happen? We're going to take the largest pool, and the insurance industries, rightfully so, are going to be out there trying to fight for this business. And how are they going to fight? How are they going to be more competitive than the other guy? Is it going to be the deals that they can cut on the health care? And if they do, who's going to pick up the rest? Thank you.
Thanks, Roxanne. Jim, wanted to comment on just that specific point, and then it's Jerry, Stern, and then Mike.
Just a couple points. And this is a very difficult area, a very complicated area. But I agree with a number of things that Roxanne said. And one, I would agree with you. Dr. Glass, you said everyone should be paying the same thing for the same service. I would agree with that. And that's why one of the first things I think you need to do in this area is get cost containment. That's where the reimbursement schedules and utilization standards come in. And that's why the way I look at it, you do that first, and then you go to the pool to provide access. Because until you control the cost, until everyone pays the same, we saw this ad hoc in the Division of Insurance last month about how I think the Division of Insurance
different rates were being charged for different
services. So I agree with you on that. Secondly, on the pooling, unfortunately, not everyone will do what you did. Some people who couldn't afford insurance for their five people won't give them the money to go out and buy. They'll just say, you're not going to get insured. We can't afford it anymore, so they won't. So I think we got to recognize that you are a very responsible employer, and other folks just may not be in the state, and so their people will go uninsured, and that's why you put together another mechanism, but you don't force anybody. For example, if you wanted to provide your own insurance outside the pool, if you could do that and you felt you could afford it, you were happy with it, that would be fine. It would be a voluntary pool where those individuals who can't cover who aren't being covered right now, can't be covered, would agree to join because they want to have insurance for their employees. So it's a fine line. It's gotta be walked. And that's why you actually start with the public sector and use them as a big gorilla, I think as Representative Ware said. But that that brings everybody to the table and helps solve the problem.
Jerry, I'm sorry it's taking so long to get to you.
This is probably one of the more interesting dialogues we've had since this task force has been able to meet. I'm very encouraged by some of the comments that I've heard, and I hope I can do it a good job. I think you're hitting the core of, a major part of the problem we're trying to solve, and that's the part that the insurance companies play. We've heard the word cherry picking. That's not an industry word. We use risk and
stuff.
We have an industry. We have a whole bunch of coal that we use as a product to sell. More or less used to complicate the appearance of the product, because if you made it simple, nobody would buy it. So maybe see it as a real value. But if we go to the pooling concept from the standpoint of just going the economies of scale, that's probably a pretty workable idea. There was a study in Wisconsin that had to do with high-risk pools. and put all the bad risks in one big pile at a rather high rate. And then all the insurers that did business in that state had to cover the deficit as part of their agreement to be in business in that state. And sort of a circuit, because it really is a big circuit. You really have not saved any money, because the shortfall in the pool is added on to the insurance company's cost of doing business in that state. So it still comes back to square one, or the person that's receiving marriage warning is the one that can't pay the bill.
Mike, and then we'll take the rest of it. And before Mike, excuse me for interrupting, before we go ahead, we need to be finished with this segment of the agenda, down through Mano's presentation by about 5 minutes after 11 today. This is a really good discussion, but we are going to have to amend the agenda a little bit to take Jack Nielsen. I want to let him know that we will take action here to make sure we get this presentation before he has to leave at 1 o'clock today. So please go ahead, Mike.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a very good discussion. You know, I think Roxana's right. We're constrained by where we are in the system that we have rather than where I think we should be, because we're a lot of what we talk about, and I expect a lot of what is suggested, is to try to make better something that may be irreparably screwed up. Of course there's cherry picking. In the insurance industry, it's a business. They're there to make money. They're not there for the social aspects of it. What we're talking about here is the social experiment. And the two don't mix very well, quite honestly. And that's why what I think maybe we need to look at something radical in our discussions. Of course, I don't know how well that plays with politicians in the group, but nevertheless, it's something that I think we need to do. In the pooling arrangement, which I think has, given the where we're at now, the system we have now, I think the pooling arrangements will be a help. They'll be somewhat of a help, but I still don't see where the administrative costs go, because they certainly don't go away. So someone has to pick them up. As far as the cherry picking goes, and whoever the pool is picking up the rest of the cherries, still costs something. And a lot of the cherries that you're going to be picking up aren't going to be able to pay, as Roxana said. A lot of the people who are most at risk or who can't pay are the lower end of the income brackets, who are just above the poverty line, but they have no disposable income for anything. Even if you make the pool available to them, they can't afford the pool. So someone has to pick up those costs, and I'm not sure that we're going to be able to, as a government, afford it, unless you take away, like I guess Jerry said, if you set up this pool where you have a high-risk pool and everybody else, and anybody who offers insurance in the state has to pick up that pool and make up the deficit for what it costs. Well, what you have there then is everybody protected in a cost-plus system, and the plus is the profit that goes to the insurance industry, which means that there's some skim off the top that isn't going to the direct service that you're trying to provide for here. But we're not going to get rid of insurance companies. I don't think we're going to make the radical jump to socialized medicine, there's no easy cures.
Mike, when you talk about radical solutions, it makes me look like less of a liberal, so I appreciate that. Larry, you have a response to that point?
Just a quick comment on Mike's observation in terms of social and profit motivations and whether they fit together. I think it's just important to point out that a lot of the administrative costs that we talk about in terms of this risk selection process, it wasn't always that way. Insurance basically back in the 50s when it started was spreading the risk across everybody. And I think too, we just need to keep in mind on this cherry picking or whatever other agricultural term we want to use, we need to keep in mind that in part, I don't think we can, if there's blame to be laid, it doesn't necessarily go entirely to the feet of the insurance industry, in the sense that it is something that is desired from the people or the populations that are purchasing coverage. I mean, it just, again, there's an issue of just good sense, if in fact the market's kind of crazy out there, of people saying, where can I get the best deal for my people or for me or for whatever. And so the market, in some ways, in terms of whether I buy from you or from someone else, there's still this element of looking for the best deal. And part of the price that is society pays for individual firms or people or whatever looking for the best price is higher administrative costs, and the people who really need it and can't ante up to the sky's the limit get sort of left out. So I think we need to sort of look at those individual decisions when we talk about cherry picking, not necessarily partially, yes, the predatory behavior by the segments of the insurance industry, but also the response from an employer who is trying to say, look, I have to provide coverage for my folks, and I can get them something over here for cheaper than I can through another mechanism where I'm sort of trying to, in a sense, sort of smooth out or subsidize some other populations or whatever. So it's in terms of why this thing has sort of splintered apart all these submarkets and all, I mean, there's lots of factors, and it isn't just one entity that comes in and causes this chaos.
Jim Gingrich is channeling for the spirit of Sister Donna today, and we're glad to have you with us, Jim. So please go ahead with your comments or hers.
These are my comments or hers. This is Jim Gingrich. Along the line of Roxanne's comment, and the combination of the insurance pooling concept, the social versus the for-profit, it's important for this committee to keep in mind that when you have insurance companies controlling costs by various means, it's making the basic assumption that if you set a fixed payment schedule or something like that, or you have a preferred provider arrangement where that pool of people are getting a fixed rate, you have to keep in mind that as cost shifting occurs, there's another variable thrown in here. Your Medicare patient, for example, the provider doesn't have the option of billing the recipient of the service for the balance. Like if they pay a DRG of $100, but the service actually costs $106, you cannot bill the recipient of the service. In the insurance world, you can capitate the payment, but then you have a right to bill the patient. And so there's various forms of cost shifting. So your major insurance pools sometimes control their costs the best because they successfully cost shift either to the recipient of the healthcare service, but indirectly they just cost shift it to someone else, which is kind of Roxanne's point. But keeping in mind there's only $1 there, there are certain payers, Medicare, Medicaid, and VA, for example, that you can't shift that, meaning if they capitate the payment, you can't go back to the recipient of the service. So keep that in mind as you try to wrestle with insurance pooling, because as you shift it around, some recipients you can't bill back for the service.
I have so many questions backed up, I can't even believe it. I can't even respond. There's some interesting points you brought up, and maybe I'll just catch you on a break and have you clarify some. I need a couple points of clarification, I guess. The other thing is, maybe I want to say to Mike first, is I was glad because of my interest in access for indigent people to hear that discussion or that point come back into discussion a little bit, although I've been sitting here not saying too much because I think that I see the pooling, and maybe inappropriately so, as a separate problem or a solution to a problem that does not necessarily take care of the medically indigent. That we have been looking at pooling for the problems that Roxanna has brought up to our attention. But some of my couple of my questions are to Senator Duncan is, in this pooling concept that the other states have, and I've read a little bit about, Do you need to be employed to join that, to buy into that pooling? For instance, if I were an employee of Roxana's, but I choose to leave and start my own business, and I'm a one entity, can you then, and I was in your pool as her employee, can I remain in the pool because I have money to buy into that pool?
I think it depends on how you want to structure it. I'm not sure what happens in other states. My view would be, yes, that pool would be open to anyone who wanted to join that pool in the state of Alaska.
Okay. And in terms of cost and administrative cost, are you looking at the when you talk about the authority, are you looking at that as a state-subsidized authority so that when you start talking about cost containment, I know that is probably more concern of yours than mine. My concern is access, but it's, you know, you keep me grounded in terms of my wanting access for everybody, but if you have a state-supported authority for this concept, you still have costs.
Well, maybe this is a very complicated area, and I tried to pass over probably the most controversial section of it lightly, but the pooling doesn't work in my mind unless you do cost containment first. I mean, the pooling is one way of providing the access. The access comes only after you've done cost containment. First, let me respond to your point right here. First of all, on the medically indigent versus the environmental, I agree with you. The idea never was to pool those folks together.
Those
are the people that I think
that's another problem.
You subsidize,
that's another solution.
You pay for them, but you do it only after you've done two things.
I
controlled costs, and you reduced the number of uninsured and underinsured. And then you identify the people who can't pay it, and we pay for it.
Depending on what the time frame of that after the fact is, I don't necessarily agree with
even
that.
Even if it takes 3 or 4 years, it's better than never doing it at all. I mean, it's not going to happen overnight. And the problem is that the easy way to solve this whole problem on access that you're concerned about is just put money in the state budget and do it. Provide access. The problem with that is, based on the information that I've seen and that our actuaries at workforce have been able to generate is that's expensive. Right now, if we were to cover everyone in the state who doesn't have access, it would cost about $60 million. And if you don't control the cost, when you pump that money into the system, you just further the problem, and that $60 million gets to be $120 million in 2 years, and it just keeps growing. So if you don't control the cost first, you never solve the access problem. More people become uninsured. So
I understand that concept, although I don't happen to be a proponent of just adding money to the state budget, but simply cost shifting some money. And I am one of those radicals who believes in doing something with a permanent dividend.
That's right.
So my solutions are not necessarily simply adding money to budget.
Right. Let me ask just one other. Let me get back to the point. It kind of gets to Mr. Grant. I don't mean to Johnny, I don't mean to monopolize here, but to Jim's point about cost shifting. Because cost shifting is a major problem, and you don't solve the problem unless you stop cost shifting. The idea behind the authority is not a state-subsidized authority, not a state-subsidized health plan. I mean, the staff of the authority, the operational cost of the authority are paid for by the state. They're part of the state appropriation process, but we don't subsidize health plans, except for those individuals who finally just can't find coverage for because of medical condition. But the way you stop the cost shifting and the way you control the cost is to do the controversial part. That's to negotiate provider reimbursement schedules with all providers and another negotiate utilization standards. Put in utilization standards that will be used by the consumers and the providers and negotiate provider reimbursement schedules. And the way we had set up was, how do you get the providers to participate? You mandate that all public employers in the state, which is 130,000 employees and their dependents, 130,000 people are presently covered by health insurance, would use those provider reimbursement schedules and utilization standards. Wouldn't tell them what kind of plan they have, whether it's the employee pays a premium or what portion he pays or whether it's 80-20, 90-10 deductible or what the benefits are. It doesn't do anything about plan design. It just says if you're a public employer, you will only pay X dollars for broken arm. And the insurance company can't balance bill. They can't go back against the individual to make up the difference. They can't cost you. Now, the danger that people say, well, wow, if that happens, then they're going to cost shift to the private sector. Well, they will, but the idea is that you then say to the private sector, those reimbursement schedules and utilization standards are available for you to use. You want to use them? Opt in and use them. Because if you don't, you may get cost shifted to. And so all of a sudden, the large private employers and small private employers say, yes, we want to use the same standards. We don't want to be paying more for broken arm than the other people are paying. And so all of a sudden, hopefully, not all of a sudden, but over time, you come to an all-payer system where everybody's paying the same for every service. And to make the doctors and the hospitals feel better, I think everyone understands those folks, there's another problem with them. They're awesome. They got to make money. And so you negotiate rates with them that allows them to do that, right? I mean, you don't undercut them. You don't do what Medicaid or Medicare does now, pay 50 cents on the buck, right? You pay them what they're, and it's provided for in legislation, what their actual costs are, and cost of doing business, make a profit, et cetera. But you cost them by doing that, so you stop the cost shift, because everybody's paying the same if they'll opt in and use those schedules. Then, as you're doing that simultaneously, you're identifying the people who aren't being covered right now. You identify the small retail groups of folks, put them together into a pool. They use the same provider reimbursement schedules and utilization standards. You design a plan for them, the state Mickey does. You go to the private sector and say, come in, offer me, you know, give us a pull on the plan. I think the insurance industry will respond. If they don't, then the state finally says, fine, go off with the insurance and collect the premiums. And you stop the cost shifting, you hopefully control the cost, you can improve access, and then you identify the people that you're really concerned about, those who can't. No, I mean, they would love to have insurance, they just can't afford it. They don't make any money. They're making money. And the state provides security. So it's controversial and complicated, but I'm convinced it works. But that's radical.
It's your baby.
I like it. Rod and then Mark.
Rod Wilson, Johnny, I'd like to talk, but I yield to you. I know you've got some comments on this, and I want you to leave yourself time enough to say something yourself. You haven't listed yourself as among those who want to speak to this issue. Are you going to?
I am planning to.
I thought earlier you said you were.
No.
Wanted to say something.
No.
It seems to me the key to much of this discussion is whether we're going to continue the understandable but pernicious practice of medical underwriting or not. That's the nub of it now. So long as you do that, then you're going to cast people into certain pools, as cherries or otherwise, rotten cherries or otherwise, and you're going to end up with a class system or a tiered system of care, whereas some people get what the unions used to have, a Cadillac, and now they characterize it as a Buick. Other people get, at the bottom of this scale, get a very narrow, niggardly package of preventive and other care. Some of the elements in it will be good, but it's not nearly a full spectrum of care that other people get, and will perpetuate a class system of care in this country. Now, it may be better than what's going on now with such pools, but not a whole lot better, I suspect. If we abolish medical underwriting, that might not be insurance anymore, as Dave Walsh pointed out in the meeting upstairs last time. You can still call it that, but it's really not insurance. It's cost plus or agreeing to fund the health care by payment in advance. I think, and I agree with Senator Duncan, at the same time you do this, or perhaps even before, you have to have stringent cost controls. And I suspect, without knowing for sure, that providers, or at least the doctors, would go along with this so long as they were free to take care of everybody in a full spectrum kind of way. It's one thing to say you'll treat a kid for asthma on an outpatient basis because outpatient is covered, but what if that kid stops breathing or is about to stop breathing? They got to go out of the hospital. Do you stop care there or say, well, you got to go get somebody else or it's not covered? It just doesn't work that way. And I suspect that the physicians would hope that they would go along with that kind of cost control so long as there were some good quid pro quos in terms of tort reform, quick pay, turnaround, and so forth. Finally, just to come back to my citation of Professor Hertzlinger, again, I was not endorsing. I was just citing that as a middle ground between going on with the employer-based insurance and a full, say, universal social health care system. And I'll give the reference to Nancy because it's a very provocative article, and everybody but Nano said he didn't want to read it.
We can't separate the two of them. It's too Mark is, and I apologize here. Please understand the vagaries of a list of this many people wanting to join in the discussion. Mark is next, and then Chris.
Today's discussion makes me think we, you know, take one step back forward and like several steps back, but it is an interesting thing. And I was going to make a comment about the Magilla gorilla in the marketplace and how the gorilla walks in the door. And then Jerry made me think of, you know, Malcolm the spider monkey and how he walks in the door, you know, all by himself and a much smaller beast in the forest. And I know that, I mean, that, and I kind of been always intrigued by permanent fund dividend discussions, but I know that that if I'm not in a group, if I'm not an employee that's covered some way, I mean, my New York Life agent Fairbanks assures me that I can walk in the door, and unless I've got something really oozing out of my system, that I'll be able to buy something for about $90 a month. And when you think of, that's a pretty basic package, but nonetheless that I can access a policy in the state, which is not, when you think about it, much more than we're giving out to every living, breathing being on this in a state in the permanent fund dividend. And maybe Jerry's the right person to answer that, but you sell these things to folks. So I'm Malcolm Spider Monkey, and I'm coming in your door, and I'm not employed anywhere necessarily, but I want to buy some coverage, and can I get that for something not much more than the permanent fund dividend?
That's really pretty cool. It'd be a higher deductible pay coverage.
Like $500 or what?
Maybe $1,000, depending on your family's age range. There are several companies, Blue Cross being one, that has sort of come in with just a basic health insurance plan that's probably even going to be less than that.
Chris and then Karen.
Thank you so much. I'd like to comment on a couple of things that we talked about, namely this cherry-picking thing. And because there's an impression that what's going on is all cherry-picking, that is not correct. I'd say close to 50% of the market is not cherry-picking. 50% of the market is handled what's called an experience rate, cost plus. Now, for what we heard today, it would be reasonable to assume, well, therefore, those guys who have experience rated, i.e. pooling arrangement, will get a better deal. It is not so. Think about the state employees. The state is paying $385 a month per state employee, and that's a pooling concept. There is no administrative cost other than the eligibility and the claims handling. There is a risk premium involved here that's an integral part of that. If the losses are less than the premium, then those losses, if the losses are less than the premium, then that difference, after taking out the administrative cost, which is relatively small, 8%, goes back to the state. So that kind of arrangement is going on up to 50%. But what's really happening is that in the cherry picking comparison, there are some so-called bad cherries. Those who have bad losses, those people, if they wouldn't leave the state, would have nowhere to go. They would be on the street, would become Medicare cases. And so pooling is okay, and it's definitely a good approach. But keep in mind that a pooling arrangement can be very expensive based on your how the makeup is of your group. And as Rob saying addressed, and interesting to what I mentioned before, that can happen to a small group, it can happen to a big group. And ultimately, bad people with medical inability, with medical problems, will cost a lot of money. That's a given. And the only difference we have right now in the marketplace is that if somebody has a medical problem, but is lucky enough to be in a non-underwritten group, like an experience-rated group, for example, the state or other big groups you have in the state, then they're taken care of. The other folks are not. And with that, I'd like to close. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Karen, and then Dave.
I guess I'm struck by the concept of the word charity first, in the sense that we could look at these from the not point of view of the system, but the point of view of an individual. The bottom line about this, and maybe the difference in the one of the markets that we're trying to reach that's different than the analog market is that we're trying to attract people to solutions, with products that are going to solve their problems, right? And it seems to me, having just gone through changing carriers and going to $1,000 deductible in our, my husband's firm, and being one of the people on the policy, that the number one of the number one considerations is affordability. And it's not the only consideration, but it is a major consideration. And so it seems to me like that backs me up to a couple of big questions, and maybe now the only time we're going to get the luxury to sort of talk to everybody about this, because we're going to pretty soon have to get in and start crunching numbers. You know, it's great to talk about who we and who should be in, who should be out, but I think the number one success rate is going to be, are we going to be able to provide a product that people are going to want to buy? It seems to me like I haven't decided this, but I think that the fact is that there probably is not enough money in the healthcare system today to do everything that we want to do as a goal. Create access for everyone, pay providers fairly, make sure insurance companies don't go out of business, make sure people don't get bankrupt. But there probably is more money in the system than we can probably squeeze a fair amount of money out of the system. And if we had a full template of options, we could probably squeeze maybe 3/4 of the money out of the system to make our product affordable, to make the product affordable for everyone. By doing administrative efficiencies, by controlling provider rates, by doing all these things. Now, there are going to be some of these doors that are going to be closed to us for various reasons on a state level, or going to be closed to us politically or regulatorily or whatever. We should focus on those doors that are open and try to get things from the system that we can squeeze out in terms of money. And then I think we're going to have to face the fact that we are going to have to probably inject some money into the system to take care of some of the sort of the flush that isn't there yet, that isn't there right now. If we want to make these products affordable and if we want to reach people who are not currently insured. But I guess, and I really enjoyed the discussion this morning, but I do think that we need to be thinking about it from the point of view of the individual who's out there in the market and what do they want to buy. Getting a real handle on that, because we can talk about pooling, we can talk about, you know, broader schemes, right? It has to come down to the decision. Do we believe that the product we're going to offer is going to fill that market edge?
And that is one of the objectives of the resolution establishing this task force, to get to that nitty-gritty kind of deep level of detail in a plan that is realistic and acceptable to the public. I just distributed to you a sheet there that if you're interested in getting a sandwich from the Pickle Barrel Deli for the building, please fill out that form and make sure you put your name at the top. Nancy will help us coordinate and collect the money later, but we do plan a working lunch here. If you wanted to take advantage of the curry, it's not here behind this building. I guess the van's going to pull up behind the next building if you wanted to run over there at 11:30 and get some of that, but we're going to keep powering through the agenda here. I do want to take about a 5-minute break right now and then come back immediately to get through the next part of this. And as I said, we've got to, during that break, I'll consult here with Senator Duncan and the staff to figure out how we're going to get down to the Medicaid, Jack Nielsen from the Medicaid Rate Advisory Commission to get this presentation in before 1 o'clock. So with that, let's take, please fill out the forms, let's take a 5-minute break, and come back right away.
If you take assignments, but if you don't take assignments,
hospitals are mandatory.
Right.
Yeah.
But that's not. Okay, that clarifies it. I mean, there are many private physicians in this town who are not Medicare. They will not accept assignment. And there are many, many, many doctors in this town who are staff members of Providence who will not take Medicare assignment. And therefore, they
are. What I understand, they're adding 10 to 15% on it.
Right, for the outpatient. Which for lots of people, that's so they all take home.
I mean, all the hospitals pay 10 or 15%. Into the fund and just insure all these people.
Don't love to hear that.
Oh, yeah.
They don't take the assignment. A lot of them, I mean, they'll take Medicare because Medicare is better, but a lot of them will not take Medicare.
Use some form of what I'm going to explain how our plan works. And the other industry in this state that I am aware of, there are some of the fish canneries, some of the fish cannery employees that are represented by one of the unions that also use the same type of concept. The variable is the number of hours that it takes to create a benefit for a particular month. And I'll just explain through the process of how our plan, how the laborer's plan works. The contribution rate is $2.58 an hour. So for every hour worked, $2.58 is paid by the employer on a monthly basis to the trust fund. To receive a month's coverage, and it includes not just the premium for the participant, but I mentioned earlier in my earlier remarks that the active participants offset a considerable expense for the retirees' coverage. And now, in fact, the actives contribute 70% of the premiums for the retirees.